whenever we remember something, it's not just as simple as pull a file out, read it, put the file back. It's not. We pull the file out, we read it, and we make a couple of notes and we make a couple of changes and then we put it back. And so with MDMA, when you pull the file out, you're in a place of openness and trusting and bonding and acceptance, and you're deeply in a parasympathetic state. You can rework the memory. You can add a little bit of a narrative. You can just, if nothing else, fully accept that this thing happened to you. You can incorporate it and integrate it into your narrative and be like, yes, this terrible thing happened.
Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for joining me. On the podcast today, I had the great pleasure of chatting with Dr. Julie Holland. Julie is a psychiatrist specializing in psychopharmacology. She's the author of 5 books and frequently appears in the news media as a mental health expert, including on CNN, Fox, Good Morning America, and The Today Show. She has a long history as an advocate for the safe and therapeutic use of psychedelics and cannabis. And she is a medical monitor for 2 MAPS studies of PTSD, MAPS being the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And she has a private practice in New York. Our conversation covered the role of the parasympathetic nervous system, the benefits of connecting to ourselves and how to do it, the role of mindfulness and psychedelics in accessing parasympathetic states and connecting to ourselves, why connecting to others is essential for health and well-being, the power of MDMA to promote healing through connection with others, how psychedelics can contribute to collective healing around ongoing traumas such as the global pandemic, climate change, political polarization, etc., how to navigate the more challenging aspects of intimate relationships and the role that oxytocin plays in that, and the future of psychedelic medicine. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And without any further delay, here is my interview with Dr. Julie Holland. Dr. Julie Holland, welcome to the Mindspace Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I am just so incredibly excited. Finished your book a few weeks ago, wanted to write everything down and ended up taking some notes to prepare for this. And I just can't wait to get into it. Can we start with maybe just your bio? Like, what do you do? How did you get there?
Sure.
And how you arrived at this amazing book called Good Chemistry?
Sure. Where to start? I was born in 65. I grew up in a suburb of Boston in the 70s. There were a lot of drugs around me and my neighborhood and my community sort of growing up. So I was very curious about drugs and how they worked in the brain. I was a really smart kid. I was very interested in psychology. I had like a subscription to Psychology Today when I was in high school, and I went to Penn because they had a major called the biological basis of behavior, which was really like neurobio, neuropsych, and psychopharmacology. So I spent a lot. I took like almost every course in that major. I stayed every summer to take more classes, except for one lovely last summer at summer camp. So I was pretty sure, I mean, I was definitely pre-med. I knew I was going to be a doctor. I knew I was going to do something with the brain. I didn't know if it was be like neurology or neurosurgery or psychiatry, but just because I had this sort of innate curiosity about drugs, psychiatry made the most sense to me. So I was really studying psychopharm at undergrad. And this one summer, 1985, that was the summer that there was a lot of press coverage about MDMA, which today people call it Molly. It used to be known as ecstasy. And before that, it was actually known as Adam. But I was pretty sure I was going to be a psychiatrist at some point. And then I was learning that summer that there was a new drug that therapists and psychiatrists were using, you know, during therapy as a catalyst to make the therapy go deeper. So I got very interested in that. It sort of supercharged my interest to definitely go to medical school, be a psychiatrist. So I stayed in Philly because I was singing in a band that was actually doing pretty well, and I couldn't leave. So I took a year off between undergrad and med school to just kind of rock out and front the band and rode a motorcycle around and got my yayas out a bit. And then I went to Temple Med. And then after that, I went to Mount Sinai Medical School, really wanted to be in New York City. And after 4 years of a, not medical school, excuse me, after sort of getting my yayas out, I went to, after Temple Medical School, I did my psychiatric residency at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And I absolutely really wanted to be in New York City. I applied to 7 psych residency programs, all in Manhattan. I stayed at Mount Sinai. I did some schizophrenia research that got me very interested in the glutamate system, which got me more interested in things like ketamine and PCP. After my Mount Sinai residency, I got this amazing job working Saturday nights and Sunday nights only, with all week off to recover. But it was running the psychiatric emergency room at Bellevue Hospital. So it was a really perfect job for me. It was kind of like rock and roll psychiatry. You know, it was overnight. It was like a 15, 16 hour shift. And when I wrote Weekends at Bellevue, I really described the shift as like a psychedelic experience that, you know, you really have to sort of let go and surrender. And, you know, you're a cog in a wheel. You just have to kind of go with it. You don't know what you're going to get. You have to be in a very fluid state. And you're going to be changed. You know, after those 15, 16 hours, you're going to come away, having grown and changed from the experience. So it was the best job I ever had or ever will have. And then during that time where I was working weekends at Bellevue, I developed a private practice in psychiatry and psychopharmacology that really had a basis in harm reduction, which meant that I would not absolutely insist on complete abstinence. You know, psychiatry has this crazy thing where if you're an alcoholic and you come to somebody, they'll be like, as soon as you stop drinking, I can give you medicines. And same thing with drug use. And harm reduction says, you know, I'll take you where you are. We'll start from where you are and we'll, you know, arrive at some place that's healthier together, the two of us. So I developed a pretty big private practice in New York City. And after years of practicing in that way, I wrote a book called Moody Bitches, which is about how women are over-pathologized, that the whole emotionality and fluidity, the whole emotionality and fluidity that many women possess is natural and normal and doesn't necessarily have to be medicated away. You know, when so many women are on birth control and on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medicines so that they will be more sort of stable and less fluid. And that's not always to their advantage, or I would even say to society's advantage. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called Medicating Women's Feelings that was incredibly popular and like the most emailed op-ed for a few weeks. And they used it as clickbait to get more subscriptions at the time. So I knew they thought it was an important piece. But it shows that, you know, there's a real resonance there that that people are sort of being over-medicated, that natural human emotion is being targeted as pathology. In women primarily, but sometimes in men and in boys. And, you know, we end up with this sort of overexpression of yang and an underexpression of yin. And it's causing a lot of problems in our society and in our relationship with the planet. That's a long answer. I hope it gave you enough to work on.
Oh, yeah. I'm feeling very much with you and very much ready to pick up on some of those threads. Let's get into good chemistry. Yeah, I don't know actually if you wanted to make the link from Moody Bitches to how you arrived at good chemistry to kind of close the loop there.
I would love to do that. So so Moody Bitches has a very long subtitle. It is the truth about the drugs you're taking, the sleep you're missing, the sex you're not having, and what's really making you crazy. Mm-hmm. So the end of the book is what's really making you crazy. And the answer in a word is disconnection, that we are disconnected from nature, from our own natural selves. We are disconnected from our bodies. You know, we spend so much time sort of disembodied because we are online or on social media, or we're just, you know, our heads are in our phone and our posture suffers for it. Our, you know, our whole body mechanics suffer because we are so disconnected. And then this idea that we're disconnected from nature, from each other. So good chemistry really picks up where Moody Bitches left off, which is exploring this disconnection. And more importantly, you know, what's the solution? What's the answer? Where do we find connection? You know, because that really is our salvation. You know, we are social primates. We are, you know, it is sort of baked into our genetics and our behavior that we survive by collaborating, cooperating, and being social. And, you know, as much as you may argue that fight or flight is the key to our survival, I would say, you know, when we were living on the savannah and we were being picked off by, you know, saber-toothed tigers or something to that degree, then I would say, yes, if you couldn't run away, you weren't going to survive. And if you couldn't, you know, be aggressive and fight something, you were not going to survive. But the opposite is also true, even back then, which is that if you were not socially connected, you would not survive. If the tribe didn't like you and they expelled you, you were going to get picked off because you were not with the herd. And if the tribe didn't like you and expelled you, they were not going to share their food with you. They were not going to help you build a shelter. So you would not survive if you were not socially knit into the community. So it is sort of hardwired into our genetics and into our behavior that we do care deeply whether we are connected or not, and that it is a key to our survival. And so now, we're in a time now where we are more disconnected than ever. I mean, you know, Good Chemistry was written before the, you know, novel virus pandemic. So at first I was a little worried. The book was coming out in June and I was like, oh no, some of this advice is going to be problematic, because I say, you know, I give very practical advice besides breathing exercises and things that you can do on your own. I do talk about, the way to get good chemistry is like skin to skin contact and cuddling and kissing and hugging, handshakes, you know, maybe pats on the bottom if you play football, you know, that human contact and eye contact is really the thing that has us feeling safe and calm. And that's what's best for our bodies. And when we are isolated, we are in fight or flight. Just by being isolated, we are more in this mode of fight or flight. And what happens when you're in fight or flight chronically, which a lot of us are now, you know, we're stressed out and we've got a lot of adrenaline, a lot of cortisol. This is a pro-inflammatory state. It's a terrible state for your immune system to be in. It wreaks havoc on your metabolism, on your sleep, on your digestion. None of those things work very well when you're in fight or flight. That's the sympathetic mode, right? And Good Chemistry teaches that the opposite of that is the parasympathetic mode. And when you are in para, you can rest and digest. And very importantly, it's really the only time where your body can repair itself. And even more importantly, it's the only time when you can repair relationships. You know, it's not running away or fighting, it's staying and connecting and collaborating and coordinating. So when you're in the parasympathetic, you are open to cooperating and to bonding and trusting. And so as much as cortisol and adrenaline sort of fuels and lubricates the sympathetic nervous system, oxytocin is what fuels and lubricates the parasympathetic system. So oxytocin is what enables that trusting and bonding. Oxytocin enables wound healing, and oxytocin, very importantly, enables neuroplasticity, which is, when it really comes down to it, neuroplasticity is about growth and change. Neuroplasticity, as many of your listeners know, is sort of about the brain making new connections and even making new brain cells, right? So new connections is synaptogenesis, and making new brain cells is neurogenesis. And what I talk about in Good Chemistry is that not only does oxytocin enable this neuroplasticity, but it turns out that a lot of what some people would call drugs of abuse or illegal drugs, but I would call sort of psychedelic medicines or consciousness medicines, but things like cannabis, psilocybin, ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic tea, these things enable neuroplasticity also. And ketamine also. So there's a lot of psychedelics that put us in a state where we are really open and vulnerable to learning and to integrating new information and to neuroplasticity. So it really comes down to, like, you could colloquially sort of think of it as rewiring or reworking circuitry. So these psychedelic-assisted psychotherapies Which I explain in tremendous detail, not only in the Book of Chemistry, but also online. I've got, if you go to my website, like drholland.com or weekendsatbellevue.com or moodybitches.com, it all takes you to the same place. But one of the things I love about Good Chemistry is it's got about 60 pages of notes online. So you can learn a lot more about what I'm writing about. You know, the book itself is only like 250 pages. I really tried to keep it as short as I possibly could. I know we all have no attention span these days. Mm-hmm. So all right. I think I've gone off the rails enough that you should get me back on, Joe.
I'm very happy to do that. And you kind of covered at a high level what I wanted to sort of get into. And what I'm seeing is that the rest of our time together is going to be unpacking. So I was going to ask you, what's para? Why is it such a big deal? Which I feel like you've covered.
I mean, the only reason why I call it para, you know, is that parasympathetic is just too long and complicated. But really, it amazes me that more people don't know about it, haven't heard about it, that we don't focus on it more. You know, when we tell somebody like, oh, you should do yoga or meditation, you know, we're really saying you should put yourself in para. Mm-hmm. In Good Chemistry, I talk about a couple of ways that you can quickly put yourself into para. Just breathing in and out through your nose is very helpful. Yeah. Breathing in and out through your left nostril is even more helpful. Making sure your exhale is longer than your inhale, which you can do if you're monologuing like I am, or if you're talking or whistling or playing a musical instrument or chanting, any of those things with a long exhale can help to put you into para. So yes, that's enough about para.
Okay. Yeah. I agree, by the way, that it's an underappreciated state of the nervous system. And I thought it was great that you really picked it up and kind of rebranded it in a way.
Thank you.
I want to, again, in this process of like unpacking that awesome synopsis you gave, I want to just, you know, mention to listeners that read the book that the book has a very cool structure, which is you talk about connection at different levels. So you've got starting with connecting with the self, connecting with a partner, connecting with family, connecting with community, connecting with the earth, connecting with the cosmos. So I actually would recreate that structure a little bit to kind of get through some of these questions. Given, again, that sort of nice overview you've given us already, what do you mean by connecting with the self? And what about the fact that a lot of what you were saying earlier about feeling safe and feeling kind of grounded and healthy comes out of a need, even biological need, to be connected to others? So how do you carve out what it means to be connected to oneself and how to do it?
You know, it is a little bit like that cliche where you can't really love somebody else until you learn to love yourself. And I would say that you can't fully connect with somebody else until you are personally connected yourself. So one of the issues is that people can have very fragmented personalities, that they can be very compartmentalized. And sometimes this happens because of trauma. You know, you learn to shut down certain parts of yourself that got rejected. You learn to toughen up certain times when, you know, you were made fun of if you were soft. So part of it is just this integrating all the different facets of the self into something unified. So that's sort of the stuff that goes on cognitively or emotionally. But then there's just this issue, as I said, of physicality, of being embodied, being in your body, embodying yourself, inhabiting your body, and how important that is to staying healthy. You know, it's so easy for us to sort of escape the present moment, you know, jack into something that you're watching on your laptop or on your phone, and you're really not there, you're elsewhere. So the first level of connecting is just connecting to the self, connecting to the present moment. So, and trying to get a sense of the sort of the dissonance or the rivalries or, you know, the what goes on internally between the different parts of yourself. So that's pretty much the first chapter.
I've been meditating for over 20 years, and I've been teaching mindfulness meditation for 10 years. And I found this, I think you talk about mindfulness and as a tool for connecting with oneself. And obviously there's a lot of interesting research pointing to the health benefits of doing that. It is a solitary activity. It is about connecting, finding a relationship to oneself. But one of the things I've noticed in teaching meditation is just how difficult and stressful it can be for people to unplug, right? To stop looking at their phones, to stop being distracted by whatever,
right,
and just sit and do nothing.
Right.
And I guess I wanted to just explore this framing with you that mindfulness is a tool for achieving para. And what I see is that in many cases, for many people, for beginners and maybe even some more expert meditators, practicing mindfulness is not at all a pathway to para. In fact, sometimes meditating can be very activating and sometimes in a really good way. The goal of meditation is not to relax. It sometimes has that effect, but what we're going for, obviously, is deeper understanding, greater insight into the nature of existence, the nature of the self, this sort of thing. So how do you see the role of mindfulness meditation beyond just sometimes helping us slide into para?
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree that the whole point of really sitting with yourself and your thoughts is to see where your thoughts go and get a better sense of your, you know, the nature of your own mind. But then there's other kinds of meditation, like an open-eyed meditation where you're taking everything in, where it really is just focusing on presence, right? And being fully present. You know, it's funny how many of my patients are like, oh, I could never meditate. I can't stop thinking.
Exactly.
You know, and
exactly.
I have to say, yeah, like, none of us can stop thinking. You know, and I would not say that the goal of meditation is to stop thoughts, but I do have this sense sometimes when I'm trying to meditate that if nothing else, I would like to dilate the space between my thoughts. I would like to have that little breath in between where things are quiet. Like, you know, it's lovely when it happens. I don't, you know, force it to happen. But I would say that particular state, when you happen to have a little bit of space between thoughts, for sure would be para. But in terms of like getting a better sense of personal nature and integrating all the selves, you know, one of the things I bring up in that first chapter, actually two things I bring up, one is cannabis and the other is MDMA, that I start to sort of introduce the idea that there are, illegal drugs, let's say, at least in America right now, where they can help to enable mindfulness. They can help you to see sort of the lay of the land and where your automatic thoughts go and, you know, what sort of issues arise for you, that they also are tools. And you know, there is actually talk of doing an MDMA mindfulness study to look at what the impact of MDMA is on mindfulness. Back in the 70s and 80s, when people were just starting to experiment with MDMA, there was a monk who had been meditating for decades who was like, oh, when I take this pill, it feels like the thing I've been trying to do for decades, you know, so there may be a little bit of crossover there. And, you know, cannabis for mindfulness and for meditation, I mean, I'm certainly not the first person to write about that and talk about that. But these are potentially medicines like mindfulness that can help us understand ourselves better. And so maybe acutely understanding yourself better and looking at your trauma is going to put you in the sympathetic mode. But optimally, over time, when you really, you know, pardon the vernacular, but when you really figure your shit out, you can be in para more often overall.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned psychedelics giving greater access to neuroplasticity. How do psychedelics help us connect with ourselves?
So I think cannabis is a perfect example. You know, I definitely think of cannabis as a psychedelic. You know, maybe it's not a major one, maybe it's a minor one, but I do feel like it is mind manifesting. And you know, when I use cannabis, one of the things I regularly notice is that I immediately become much more aware of you know, I have like an enhanced kinesthetic awareness. In other words, I see where my body is in space. I inhabit my body more. I become more embodied. And I just become much more aware of how I'm holding my body or how my posture is. So that already, to me, is enhancing a connection with self. But also, I think because it is mind manifesting, because it does sort of allow, it engenders a certain amount of creativity or more thinking, you know, I can get a better sense of what sort of things are on my mind or what I'm thinking about. And also, and maybe not everybody has this, but I definitely have this. I find cannabis to be a real heart opener for me. If I'm sort of arguing with my partner and shut down and getting defensive, if I smoke, I feel much more emotionally relaxed and open and able to sort of have the hard conversations, to actually stay and be present with my own feelings and with the feelings of somebody else. So, I mean, that's my personal experience. And in chapter one, I do write about MDMA for a couple of reasons. One is my the first time I ever took MDMA, which was back in 1985 when it was still legal, although I will say it's not the last time I've ever taken it. I had a really clear experience of, oh my gosh, there's so many different facets of my personality and I have to get them all on the same page. You know, we have to be on the same team. If we are on the same team, we can be effective. If there's like a saboteur among the ranks, then there will be sabotage and we will not get where we want to go. And there was just like some sort of agreement, you know, with me and all the various facets of myself that like we were just going to work as a team. And it's funny because I feel like, you know, my husband Jeremy and I have made that same sort of commitment to each other over and over, you know, that we are going to be on the same team. You know, it's like when you yell at the kids playing soccer and they start fighting over the ball and you're like, same team, you know, it's the same kind of thing, whether it's just one person or, you know, a group or a family or a community, that if, you know, we can all make the decision that we're going to get along, we can accomplish so much. You know, I remember a long time ago having a conversation with a member of the I've been involved in drug policy for 25, 30 years. And talking with a representative from from MPP about, you know, how MPP and Normal and DPA and all these people who are trying to advance medical cannabis and legal cannabis, why can't you guys all work together? You know, why is there so much territorial pissings? Can't you see that you all want the same thing? You know, so you can spread that out on a larger scale. You know, this idea of same team, that it can just even be one person.
I do integration therapy for a ketamine clinic here in Montreal. And I've been blown away by the impact of that drug, which I consider to be a psychedelic, in creating this very clear signal around self-compassion and self-love, which really sort of resonates with the idea of like same team and like, I really need to take care of myself because I'm precious and I'm important and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that is almost, you know, one thing we should sort of underscore about para is that there's a sense of belonging, that someone's got your back, right? And so like if someone holds you and strokes you, you know, there's something called havening, you know, where you like stroke the arms from your shoulder to your elbow downward over and over. And it's like you're being pet and held and attended and cared for. So that feeling, you can actually give that feeling to yourself. You know, you can make the decision that you are going to care for yourself, that you're going to pay attention to yourself, so that anything from meditating to, you know, taking a bubble bath to having a cup of tea, but anything that you do to sort of attend to your own needs, that can give you a sense of safety and soothing. And, you know, especially in these times when so many of us are isolated and we don't have somebody who can hold us and calm us, we really need to learn how to do this ourselves. And, you know, my patients, not just my patients, I would say most of us, the way that we are initially soothed as babies is orally, right? That, you know, they stick a pacifier in your mouth when you cry. I mean, if you're lucky, you get like a nipple and a breast and, you know, you get really, really held and soothed and you feel absolutely attended to and connected to something bigger than you. That will put you absolutely in para. But so when you get older, you're sucking your thumb, and then a little bit older and you're biting your nails, or then maybe you start smoking cigarettes, or maybe you sort of, you know, nibble on food all day long, or you're chewing gum. But we soothe ourselves orally. And so, you know, what's happened during quarantine when people are isolated, when you're isolated, you're sort of a little bit unsympathetic, you feel unsafe, you feel uncared for, and you don't belong to anything. And, you know, you get anxious and you start to soothe yourself. And so whether it's, you know, you're putting on weight or, you know, you're having a quarantini or two earlier and earlier in the day, but, you know, and anti-anxiety meds are really kind of flying off the shelf here. There have been some shortages of sleeping pills, anti-anxiety meds. And in certain pockets, interestingly, the ADD meds run in short supply, although that often happens. We've got supply chain issues. So people are soothing themselves, not always in the most healthy ways. So that's why I feel like, okay, well, then Good Chemistry is coming out at a good time, because, you know, people need as many tools as possible. You know, when you're in para, this is an anti-inflammatory state, right? Your body can repair itself, and it you know, to be in a sympathetic state and fight or flight and hamster wheeling is a pro-inflammatory state. So it's really bad for your body. So it's not just your mental health, but it's your physical health that really benefits from spending more time in para.
So do you know a professor named Sue Johnson?
I don't.
She's a relatively well-known couples therapist, and mm-hmm. she's largely responsible for creating something called emotionally focused couples therapy.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that I've heard of. I just didn't know it was hers. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had her on the podcast, and she's very charismatic, and I think likes to speak in hyperbole to sort of get her point across. And what she said, and she just communicates this in her books and her trainings and stuff, is that no psychological problem is an individual's problem. All psychological problems are relational. And the idea that one could calm one's own nervous system, self-regulate, so to speak, is a bit of an illusion, because even if it were possible, it would take so much energy and it would be so inefficient relative to how powerful co-regulation is, feeling supported and cared for by others,
right,
and creating safety and going into para, et cetera. So how do you see that? Do you think she's right about that? Or do you think there's a place for co-regulation and self-regulation?
So I write about co-regulation in chapter 3, which is, you know, the family chapter. So I really, the way I focus on co-regulation is like maternal infant, you know, the nursing mom, the mom that's holding the baby, and they co-regulate each other, right? Because the baby's crying, that upsets the mom picks up the baby stops crying, that soothes the mom. Baby soothe, mom soothe, co-regulation. And that totally works in relationships. Absolutely. You know, I go to Jeremy and I'm like, I've had a hard day. I need you to hold me. And he holds me and I feel better. And he feels better because he gave me something that, you know, he can actually do something that I'm asking him to do that'll make me feel better. So he gets calmer. I get calmer. That's co-regulation. But I do talk in Good Chemistry about the ability to regulate yourself, the ability to, and I do think that meditation and mindfulness can help you regulate yourself. We're talking about regulating your own emotional state. And so I think it is a bit hyperbolic to say one is never able to regulate, you know, their own emotional state. I mean, obviously there are people who are isolated. We're all terribly isolated now. And we certainly have moments during the day where we feel okay. You know, I go out into the woods and it's quiet. I don't have my phone with me. I am as peaceful as can be. You know, I don't think about the dumpster fire that is our country right now. I don't think about, you know, the global pandemic and thousands of people are dying every single day. I try to compartmentalize. I put it away. I go, there's a beautiful lake near where I live. There's like wetlands and swamp and the woods and like that. You know, if I go to nature and earth time, I can be soothed. And so maybe that means I have a relationship with the earth. All right. Mm-hmm. If she's saying you can only soothe yourself in relation to something, then I would say, well, nature soothes me. So, but I do have the ability to soothe myself. I, especially because I've practiced this a lot, I can put myself into para, you know, really easily. And I think that it is something that anybody can learn, that you can learn to calm yourself. You can learn to change the pacing of your breathing, where you put your thoughts. I do talk a lot in Moody Bitches and a bit in Good Chemistry about how anxiety is totally about projecting your thoughts into the future. And that if you bring yourself back to presence, you will naturally have less anxiety.
So we totally agree on that. And I don't do couples therapy. I do individual therapy. And I teach meditation because I believe these are powerful tools for self-regulation. Although obviously there is a relationship there too, because I'm in relationship to the client and they're in relationship to me as a therapist. I think the sort of more interesting question is the relative efficiency of these things. Her point that it's much more efficient to have a partner or a loved one soothe and be there and support you and this kind of thing. And, you know, just what is the sort of relative contribution of each of these approaches? And maybe it really depends on the person.
That is another issue, depending on the person, right? I mean, every once in a while,
you're going to come across
somebody who is not soothed. You know, first of all, everybody has a different tolerance for intimacy. I mean, this is something that Jeremy and I talk about quite a bit. You know, everyone has their own sort of personal space that they're comfortable with and psychic space and emotional space. And like, you know, oh, you're getting too close and, you know, I need you to back off. So I do think that as much as it may be an efficient means of regulation when it's interpersonal, I would also say that for most of us, our closest intimate relations are a source of not just joy, but conflict and discomfort sometimes. And, you know, all of us, I mean, there was just an article today in the Times about how, you know, divorces are up. So, you know, we're all in very close quarters. Either we're alone, which is very challenging, or where there are loved ones, which is also very challenging. Like, let's be honest, you know, I don't know too many couples who like always give the other person what they need and always get what they need. And they can always co-regulate each other. Yeah. The other thing about co-regulation that I imagine she spoke about is you can co-regulate yourselves into a very agitated, confrontational state, you know,
right?
Like
co-dysregulate.
Yeah. Like, for instance, I'm the kind of person, as you can imagine, who, you know, likes to win an argument, likes to get in the last word, will, you know, will try to one up you. And so is my husband. So therefore, when we get into it, it could just as easily escalate as de-escalate. So, you know, I love the idea of emotionally focused couples therapy. And I wrote about it in Moody Bitches. But one of the things I write about for couples therapy in Good Chemistry is I talk about MDMA assisted therapy.
Yes.
Couples.
Yes. That's my next question. I was blown away by that study when I heard about it a little while ago. I loved how you wrote about it. And to me, it's one of the most beautiful illustrations of co-regulation. So I'd love for you to tell us about it here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the first thing I will say is that it was very important to me to write about studies that maybe people hadn't heard about. You know, there's a study using MDMA in people with autistic spectrum disorder that did not get the press it should have that I wanted to write about. There was a study with couples where one member has PTSD, but both couples undergo MDMA-assisted psychotherapy by taking MDMA. And that was something I wanted to write about. And then the other issue is that both of these studies that nobody's heard of are run by women. And I really wanted to give the female scientists a chance to shine because I love Michael Pollan and I'm so grateful for How to Change Your Mind because it got so many more people talking about psychedelics and that's great. But you know, one of the few complaints that people had about that book was that it was a little bit man heavy. There weren't a lot of women in there. And it was very important to me to feature some of the women. I've been in the psychedelic community for 25, 30 years. I know lots of women. You know, every time I see a documentary on psychedelics, it's like the same dudes. And like, I love those guys. They're great. But behind those men are a bunch of women who are working their asses off and nobody ever hears from them or sees them. So I really wanted to spotlight some of the women scientists and principal investigators and associate investigators who are doing a lot of legwork and a lot of grunt work and not really getting much credit for it.
Yeah. So can you tell us about that study? I just think it's, as I said, just a beautiful illustration of the power of co-regulation. If I understand, one of the members of the couple has PTSD.
Right.
Do they both take the MDMA or is it just the non-stuff? They both take it,
Both take it. And that's what really makes it a completely different study. You know, we have been doing, like right now, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder is in the phase three of the trials so that they can be FDA approved. And right now the phase three is multi-center trials. There's a bunch of places doing MDMA assisted psychotherapy with a single person, but this is the only study where both members of the dyad are taking MDMA during the therapy. And it really allows, you know, Anne Shulgin had a great sort of explanation for MDMA couples therapy because she was somebody who did underground work with couples quite a bit. And I wrote about this in, my very first book, actually, which is a book that I edited because it had multiple authors. It's called Ecstasy, The Complete Guide. And there's an interview in there with Sasha and Anne Shulgin. The people who were too busy to write chapters, I did interviews with them like you're doing with me, and then I got it typed up. So, but Anne talks about that there's a certain sort of tit for tat that happens a lot with couples where, you know, it's like, well, I just did this because you did that. And then, you know, you did that. So then I did this. And she calls it emotional ledgering, meaning like everything goes on a ledger and everything is sort of superficial and transactional and retributional. Right. And she says that, you know, when a couple takes MDMA, they just like, they throw the ledger out the window. It doesn't matter anymore. That's like superficial shit that just doesn't matter. And they dig down to core issues. And the core things that keep coming up, because anybody who's been in a dyad long enough, you have the same argument eight different ways, it's the same stuff that keeps coming up that you can't let go. And it really comes down to like, why aren't you more like me? Why do you have to be like you and do it your way? Why aren't you more like me and do it my way? And that ends up being a good chunk of what happens. And so one of the things that happens with MDMA, and there's a lot that happens pharmacologically I would like to get into, but one of the things is that MDMA increases oxytocin. The brain is really flooded with oxytocin. And so there is this impulse to trust and bond and connect and form a dyad. And having all that oxytocin makes you feel safe. And it quiets down the amygdala. It's one of the things oxytocin does is it quiets down the amygdala. The amygdala is basically, you can think of it as like the fear center. It is sort of the emotional center when you're gonna react and retaliate. It's gonna, come from the amygdala. So when the oxytocin quells down the amygdala, the fear goes way down. You give the other person the benefit of the doubt more. I mean, this is really important that we've seen that MDMA has an impact on how you interpret social cues, and you're more likely to interpret social cues positively, and you're more likely to ignore negative social cues. So if somebody's, Mona Lisa, if you were taking MDMA, you would think like, she's totally smiling. That's not a grimace. That's not a smirk. That's not a sneer. That is just a smile. So there's sort of an alteration of how you interpret social cues. But the bottom line is that because there's so much oxytocin, you are more trusting and more bonded and more sort of committed to the team and the process. The other thing that happens, with a therapist, and you probably know about this, is there's something called therapeutic alliance, which is sort of a measurement of how bonded you feel to the therapist, how much you trust the therapist, how much you feel like they're on your team, on your side, they're trying to help you. That's therapeutic alliance. And we know that therapeutic alliance has a tremendous impact on the outcome of therapy, right? Obviously, the tighter the alliance, the more you feel like you trust your therapist, the better the therapy is going to go. It's going to be more efficient. It's going to be more effective. That's proven. So MDMA, because there's more oxytocin on board, there is this enhanced therapeutic alliance, right, between the client and the therapist. But you also get this enhanced alliance between the couples and this trust and this bonding and this like, yes, you care about me and you really want to help me. And that's why we're here, And then you feel safe and then you're in para because someone's got your back.
One of the reasons that study really blew me away is because it seems to be like sitting on much stronger and more insightful foundational assumptions about mental health or PTSD or whatever. I think there's a bias or like a certain mainstream assumption that mental illness is sort of located somewhere between the individual's ears, right? And it's like, oh, there's a serotonin isn't working properly in your brain, so you need a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And it's like we're individuals and our brains are sort of trying to create balance and health, right? And it's just not true, right? We know that we're embedded in relationships, and what we call psychopathology is not limited to our brains, but it's distributed through the sort of network. And yes, one person might have experienced something highly traumatic in a war zone or something, but how that person is sort of existing in a social network or a familial network at home is going to have a huge impact on how that person lives with that condition going forward. And so I was so touched by, I think you wrote this in the book, this idea that during one of their MDMA journeys with the therapist, the man, this soldier who had been to somewhere in the Middle East and was exposed to something very traumatic, was sort of revisiting the scene at the moment this trauma happened. And his partner had heard the story enough times that she felt that she was there with him and he felt she was there with him. Right. And they were sort of literally reliving the memory together.
Right. Except and, this time he feels safer because she's there with them. So this stuff is so interesting to me. There was a paper that posited to talk about how MDMA works. And this is one of the issues that come up is memory reconsolidation. whenever we remember something, it's not just as simple as pull a file out, read it, put the file back. It's not. We pull the file out, we read it, and we make a couple of notes and we make a couple of changes and then we put it back. And so with MDMA, when you pull the file out and you're in a completely different place, you're in a place of openness and trusting and bonding and acceptance, and you're deeply in a parasympathetic state, you can rework the memory, you can add a little bit of a narrative, you can just, if nothing else, fully accept that this thing happened to you and integrate it, and don't try to bat it away or push it down. You can incorporate it and integrate it into your narrative and be like, yes, this terrible thing happened. And, you know, I didn't cause it, doesn't make me a bad person, but it did happen. And I'm not going to live my life pretending it didn't. So, again, this is a highly neuroplastic state. There was a study by Gould Dolan, where she talked about MDMA puts the brain into this sort of highly plastic, neuroplastic state where social cues are attended to in a different way. And that highly plastic state that attends to social cues is really reminiscent of the adolescent brain. What happens in the adolescent brain? Tons of neuroplasticity, pruning, reworking. So it's a really interesting paper. And, you know, it makes me think about this idea of growth mindset, you know, versus like a fixed mindset. And this comes up in psychedelics that aren't MDMA also. And I think it's really worth mentioning that, you know, if you think about cognitive rigidity, that people have these ideas like this is the way it is and this is the way I am. And that's just the way it is. And, you know, as the Donald said, you know, it is what it is. So there's this kind of cognitive rigidity where you have a certain way of thinking and you don't take in information other than what fits into your little scheme. So we see this in, you see this in addiction, where people keep doing something over and over, even though it's clearly, you know, not working to their benefit, because they're just not sort of fully integrating that, you know, there's a downside to this. They keep thinking it's going to make them feel better and fix the thing that's broken, and it doesn't, but they keep thinking it will. So that's cognitive rigidity. And then you have something like anorexia, where people keep thinking that they're fat and they have to lose weight, even though, oh my gosh, look how thin you are. Can't you see it? No, I can't take in that information. OCD, cognitive rigidity, certain rituals, certain beliefs, even delusional stuff, delusional frameworks is a cognitive rigidity where they won't take in new information. But then you see MDMA and psychedelics in particular, and that cognitive rigidity just dissolves. You know, you see the default mode network dissolve with psychedelics. So this sort of solipsistic, self-absorbed, how am I doing? Who am I? What do I believe? You know, that is the default mode network is all about sort of self-obsessing and self-observing. And when you have ego dissolution, which happens during the peak of a psychedelic event, you will have sort of ego dissolution. That is the default mode network sort of going offline, dissolving, losing some of its coherence in the circuitry. And what you have in its place is that various parts of the brain that usually don't get a chance to communicate either in general or with each other, there's a lot more connection and communication going on in the brain because the default mode network is quieted. And so that explains a few things like how you may be able to, you know, hear colors or see music or things like that. That happens when you're altered with psychedelics. But it also can explain, and that along with the neuroplasticity can really explain, how they can be such huge, tremendous catalysts for growth and change, behavioral change. You know, that's the name of the game here, right? You want the alcoholic to stop drinking. You want the person I shouldn't say alcoholic. It's really not. I will say you want the person who has a problematic relationship with alcohol or other drugs to alter their relationship with those substances. You want the person who has anorexia to alter her or his relationship with food. We're talking about behavioral change and catalysts for behavioral change. And being able to have some plasticity and fluidity in place of the cognitive rigidity is such a tremendous tool for psychiatry, and I would say for all of medicine, because you cannot separate the mind from the body. You cannot separate psychic trauma from somatic illness. They are so intertwined, and God, we all know it, but we don't act like it. You know, we like, you give it this sort of, oh, mind body interface, you know, yoga, meditation, I hope, but we don't really fully embrace or embody the truth that how we feel emotionally and how we think cognitively has a huge, tremendous impact on how our body functions.
Yep. Thank you for that. That was really nicely done. And I agree with everything. And I think one of the exciting things about the psychedelic renaissance is the possibility that we could really start to work with that truth about well-being and work professionally and personally with that insight.
You know, you mentioned, just one quick thing. I mean, you know, we talked about mental illness, mental health, and, you know, I think what we're dancing around, but not just coming right out and saying, is that these are medicines that can help people who aren't even really that sick, that they can help people function better. They can have them have better relationships with themselves and their bodies and the way they eat and sleep and exercise, better relationships with other people, better relationship with the planet, right? We've seen that people who have psilocybin, psychedelic experiences with mushrooms, are more likely to be environmentally conscious, environmentally active. You know, there's an eco-consciousness that comes around when you feel connected to the planet that you want to take care of it. You want to tend and befriend the planet, and you want to have like a para connection with the planet where the planet takes care of you and you take care of it. And in a perfect world, you would not just co-regulate with your partners and your family and your community, but you would even co-regulate with the planet. Mm-hmm. So I know these are kind of weird issues, but what we're sort of focusing on is it's not just about people with addiction issues or people who are depressed or who have PTSD. First of all, we all have PTSD to some extent at this point. And, you know, I mean, the thing I've been saying for months is like, if you're not traumatized, you're not paying attention. There's a lot to be afraid of. There's a lot that's scary and potentially life-threatening that's happening all around us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're really hooked in the social media or you're reading the news every day, you know, those of us who are sort of empathically connected, it's like painful, you know, to take it all in. Mm-hmm. So I think that that it's always been sort of a spectrum of, you know, who is really mentally healthy and who is mentally ill. Where do you draw the line? You know, I wrote about that at Weekends at Bellevue, that I had to draw a line in the sand all the time on my shift, you know, that you're okay. Well, you're so insane. You have to be locked up against your will and you're a little less insane. So we're going to let you go walk the streets and, you know, and it's all shades of gray.
So I feel we've gotten into connection with community and the earth. I want to do one more on connection with a partner. You touched on it a moment ago, but really one of my favorite insights from your book, I just want to unpack with you here, is this notion that opposites attract and then repel. The idea, because connection, as you say, is so important, you know, perhaps especially connection with a partner, but it's also very treacherous. It's very stressful. It could be very traumatizing, right? So this is this idea that conflict and misunderstanding and not non-alignment and non-closeness is built in to the system,
right?
Because it's our very weaknesses. Yeah, it's our very weaknesses and are the holes in our development that we're trying to fill when we meet someone and become attracted to them. I wonder, if you can sort of give us the lesson on that one. I just found it super rich.
I mean, the first thing I would say is that a lot of this comes out of the work of Harville Hendrix and Helen Hunt, So the idea is that when I'll just give me as an example because it's easier to sort of get. So I had great parents. I'm not disparaging my parents. I absolutely grew up with privilege, et cetera. But there were times when my needs weren't met. There were times when I was rejected. And some of those times were when I was sort of needy, sad, scared. You know, I learned like nobody really likes you when you're sad and scared, you know, like be happy and relaxed and people will like you better. And so like, those were the messages that I got growing up. And so I learned to pack away my sad, scared self, and it worked out great for me. I could be very successful and barrel forward. But when I was finally ready to mate, you know, when I really like had gotten to that place where I wanted a partner, I found myself very attracted to somebody who, at least outwardly looks sad and scared. And I wanted to comfort him and soothe him and accept him. And I wanted to comfort and soothe those parts of myself that had been rejected and pushed away. So I form an alliance, a dyad, and then it's this, of course, you know, you complete me and you have all the parts I don't have and I have the parts you don't have. And, you know, together we make something bigger and better than either one of us alone. And that's all true. But then what happens over time is, first of all, familiarity can breed contempt. And second of all, I was taught that being sad and scared was bad and I shouldn't do it. And now I've got somebody who's doing that because I love that. But I'm also like, wait, don't do that. That's bad. You're not supposed to do that. So I end up projecting my self-hatred onto him. You know, the parts of me that got put away that I learned to hate and hide, now I hate that he has them, even though that's why we're together. You know, so you like it's projected self-hatred, basically. And it happens.
So what do you do about that?
Well, the first thing that you do is you learn about it, you understand it, you have a shorthand for it. You don't get too freaked out when it happens. You know, what's great about being with somebody after a couple decades is we can be like, oh, we're doing that thing again. You know, like that, you know, oh, wait, no, we don't want to. No, I see where this is going. But let's just stop, you know, because we've gone down that road countless times. And at least we can go, we can get there faster now. We've got the shorthand for, yeah, we're doing that thing, but you do that and I do that. Yeah, that's how, you know, so it's great to just have that kind of shorthand, but it doesn't mean it stops happening, you know, but it is. Jeremy and I right now actually are working on a book together about this issue, about staying, about staying in a relationship, staying in a marriage, the challenges of staying, the benefits of staying, you know, recognizing when you're in para. You know, one of the things that's great, again, is we have a shorthand where, you know, we'll an argument or a conversation will start to get a little more heated. The voices start to get a little louder. The fists start to get a little clenched, and we're like, oop, look at us. You know, we're not in para, you know? So I also want to mention oxytocin and orgasm because I think it's very important. So there are many times, regardless, you know, it's not just that MDMA or other drugs can enhance oxytocin. Obviously, there's all sorts of physical activities that bring about oxytocin. So skin to skin, cuddling, hugging, this all increases oxytocin. But the big one is orgasm. And when somebody enables that kind of pleasure in you, there is a physiological response of increased oxytocin, which leads to increased openness to bonding and touching and more cuddling. And it can help solidify the relationship. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of muse and worry about in the beginning of good chemistry is for those of us who are having orgasms with our laptops, are we bonding with our laptops? Or is there some neuroplastic event that's happening during orgasm where you are feeling more attached and bonded to the thing that just brought you off, which in this case is a screen? I don't know the answer to that, but it's, you know, it's a rhetorical question, I suppose, but it may turn out that there's really something there, you know, that, I mean, we know, and I wrote about this in Moody Bitches, that we know that the more people masturbate to certain fetishes and things like that, that, it, you know, they need like more and more stimulus to cause a release. You know, you have to kind of turn it up to 11. So I don't know how that affects, you know, the person-to-person sex. And, you know, with COVID-19 and, you know, everything that was turned up to 11, I guess I would say, like, everyone's stress level is pretty high. People don't have bandwidth for a lot more than what they're dealing with. And I would say many people are in fight or flight more than they're in para. And, you know, we've certainly seen in America a real entrenchment. You know, one of the things I write about in the community section is that one of the things that oxytocin does, besides all this, you know, hearts and unicorns and rainbows, is that it also solidifies group cohesion, social cohesion. Mm-hmm. So are you in my tribe and in my group, or are you in the other troop? You know, are you an us or a them? And that's sort of, you know, like the dirty underbelly, I would say, of oxytocin, is that it probably is enhancing how dug in everybody is.
Let's stay on the community theme here for a second. Again, on this issue of like the sort of mainstream psychiatry and psychopharmacology framing that we have in mental health, what's driving the psychedelic renaissance, as far as I could tell, is these clinical trials, right? The MDMA for PTSD, the psilocybin for depression. And again, what we have is a person going into a hospital, maybe there's two therapists, sometimes one therapist sort of sitting with them through their journey. It's very, very powerful. The effects are really exciting. But as a MBSR teacher, I've always been blown away by how much healing the group connection brings to each individual.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
And if you look at the, you know, how these substances were used in other cultures historically, it is often done in group setting.
Right.
I wonder what your outlook is for group-based interventions with these medicines going forward?
I would say that my outlook is incredibly sunny on this. I think it is absolutely inevitable. You know, when I was a medical student, I was doing research on auditory hallucinations, and I was running groups of people who are psychotic, and I loved it. And then when I was a psychiatric resident, I was running groups quite a bit, and on the floor in the acute units when people had been admitted. And I was sometimes making groups. Like sometimes I knew that there were like three or four people on the ward who had all been sexually assaulted, and I would have them have a group and we would talk, you know, and like they would go to a deeper place in that group with their peers who had gone through what they went through than would ever happen one-on-one. So I absolutely believe in the power of group therapy, no question. And also, especially when people are so isolated and don't have a lot of connection, like, you know, look, say what you will about 12-step programs, and we could talk for an hour about them, but there's a lot of love in those rooms. And there's a lot of empathy and compassion in those rooms because people have gone through what you're going through. And so not only is there love and support and compassion, but there's like advice and here's what helped me and here's what you can try. So, you know, that is a rich source of ways to change your own behavior in a supportive environment, right? And it's behavior change does not happen in isolation. You know, this is something that I learned and wrote about in Moody Bitches, very important to me. When you are isolated and you're in solitary confinement, for example, no learning happens in isolation. No learning happens in solitary confinement. There was a really interesting study where they had animals that they housed. It's solitary versus social. And, you know, if they took an animal out of social and they shocked it and then they put it into solitary, when they put it back into the shocking room, they didn't remember that that was a room they got shocked in. But if they took them out of social, shocked them and put them back into social, they would remember. So isolation interferes with learning on a very basic molecular level. So social connection and social support helps you learn, helps you grow. Some people are modeling healthy behavior, desirable behavior. So that's one issue. Number two, from a purely economic standpoint, there's no way that if you're going to scale this kind of disruptive technology upwards, that you're going to be able to have what we have now, which is, excuse me, two clinicians, one research subject, 8 hours. Like that's just what, you know, I can't imagine too many insurance companies that are going to pay for that. So I think it is inevitable that this sort of work ends up being done in groups. And I also think there's a lot of models for really great group therapy. I mean, first of all, there are, you know, indigenous models of psychedelics being used in a group setting. Although honestly, some of the earliest models are that only the shaman took the psychedelic.
Right.
And the other people kind of went along for the ride. And it was, you know, like, I'm sorry if this is sort of minimizing, but like almost like a contact high, you know, but we really, I think in our Western culture have said like, oh, we all want to be the shamans. We all want to drink. So, now, you know, we have ayahuasca circles, which is, I think a really great model for, first of all, there's a lot of neuroplasticity that happens with ayahuasca, tremendous amount. And for people who go away for a weekend, say to a retreat, and they might drink ayahuasca two nights or three nights, and then the days in between those nights, they are processing, they're talking about their experience, they're having group experiences, or they're just relaxing, you know, that ends up being a really potent, you know, 3-day experience for people. They come away from those retreats with like really major changes in how they're thinking and how they're behaving. So I think, and I'm sure, and with ketamine, I think it's very easy to scale up ketamine so that you're doing group sessions.
Hmm. What do you think the obstacles are to bringing this into the mainstream? Like, why isn't it happening already more?
So there's a few things. Number one is that these drugs are still illegal and they're still at the research stage. Number two is, I don't know how to put this. So, right now, mostly the people who are having these experiences are privileged people with money. And that's not necessarily the people who really need this the most. So one of the things that really has to happen is that people who are marginalized and people who are underrepresented and people who do not have access. You know, we in this country where I am sitting right now, the United States of America, there is like gross inequality on access to medical care, medical attention, medical devices, all of it. So that is something that really has to change. And one of the ways that it could change is if insurance agrees to cover these procedures, which means also, you know, developing procedure codes. Like we have these things called CPT codes, which is how you bill insurance. There's no CPT code for MDMA assisted psychotherapy right now, but there will be, and there needs to be. And then the question is, you know, do the insurance companies think that this is a 3-hour process, a 4-hour process, an 8-hour process? Will they pay for multiple sessions? Will they even pay at all? Like right now, none of this is reimbursable. I know some ketamine clinics are getting pretty good reimbursement. So I do think that there is a precedent for getting these sort of kinks worked out with ketamine, which is legal. And, you know, I absolutely think that ketamine, of course, has its place in the sort of armamentarium of consciousness medicines. But right now it's sort of leading the way because it's legal. And this issue of getting insurance to pay for it is one of the obstacles. Then the last little obstacle I'll mention, not so little for people who experience it, but in the scheme of things, statistically, it is little, which is something that I call shamans behaving badly, which is practitioners, researchers, private practitioners, clinicians, shamans, who are taking advantage of people when they are in a vulnerable, altered state, having inappropriate sexual relationships, either without consent or with consent, but there's a huge power differential. These things need to be addressed. They don't happen all the time, but they happen enough that we need to pay very close attention to when they're happening, how they're happening, who is doing the offending, and then what is done about these offenses. Because right now, because it's mostly underground, there isn't a real process for, you know, like, will there be some sort of a certifying body who decides, okay, well, you've done enough certification work and you've had enough work with a mentor and now you're able to do this work on your own. Like right now, there's nothing like that, right? There's, you know, with research, there are, you know, MDs and PhDs and they're licensed. With the underground therapists who are out there, some of them have MDs and PhDs and are licensed and are social workers and some of them aren't. And do we grandfather in the people who've been underground therapists for 25 years? So lots of questions, don't have a lot of answers. It's stuff that I think about, I'm working on.
Sure.
But those are some of the sticky points that need to be worked out.
But what about the obstacles to group-based psychedelic treatments joining the more individual-focused approaches in the most up-to-date protocols for this kind of work?
So again, I would say sunny, optimistic, glass mostly full kind of thinking is that there really aren't any obstacles to this, you know, to this group work happening. We're seeing more studies coming out about group work. I just said group work. There's a little blooper. that belongs in the shamans behaving badly section. So there are studies coming out about group work. I talk about group work in Good Chemistry. It is happening. It will happen. I don't think there are obstacles. I think from a financial point of view, it's sort of a no-brainer that you know, it's not really sustainable. I mean, I thought there's always going to be people who can afford to spend, you know, anywhere between $500 or $1,500 to have like a, you know, an underground person spend the day with them. But, you know, optimally, this is something that's scaled up. You know, the reason why I say that it's like a disruptive medicine or a disruptive technology is because the way psychiatry works right now is that you take a daily dose of a medicine and it may not make you feel more connected to anybody. It may just make you not mind that you're disconnected. But a lot of the medicines that we use in psychiatry, they sort of just kind of help you sweep dirt under the carpet, you know, and go about your day. And the psychedelics really allow you to take the carpet out back and beat the hell out of it and vacuum the floor and put the carpet back down. And it's a huge difference. And you're not taking your daily dose. You know, the people who went through the MDMA PTSD protocol, more than 2/3 of those people at the end of the study, if they had gotten MDMA, and not placebo, they did not meet criteria for PTSD. They could not be re-enrolled in the study, you know, that they didn't. And in other fields of medicine, you might say that those people are cured. You know, we don't like to say cured in psychiatry, you know, maybe because we like people to keep coming back. I don't know. But these are people who, you know, have gotten off their meds, stayed off their meds, don't have the symptoms that they had that brought them in the first place. And we're seeing sustained stability and improvement and lack of symptoms. So there's really something here. And the efficacy is what is going to drive all of it. The data is very impressive. The data are very impressive, excuse me. And, you know, this is going to be an efficacy-driven wellness field, just like cannabis is.
All right, I'm starting to be mindful of the time here. Yes, and
that's good mindfulness, Joe.
Thanks.
That's a perfectly good place to wrap up.
Thank you so much for doing this. And I'll just reiterate that I really enjoyed Good Chemistry. I'm so glad the book is out there because it's communicating so effectively some of the things that I sort of hold dear and want other people to kind of get on board with. So thanks for that. And thanks for joining me here. And can't wait to see what comes out of your pen next time.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it. I agree that there, you know, I really want to be very concise and succinct in imparting a lot of very important, useful information to people. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do that.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks a lot again and take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.